morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barton in Washington. Today is Wednesday, July 12, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Malawi's anti-corruption bureau chief says the fight against graft continues despite what she calls corruption fighting back.
When I hear stories from across Africa from my colleagues, usually you don't see an anti-corruption bureau or an anti-corruption agency like ours dealing with grand corruption of a current government. This is what we've done.
Amnesty International calls on Western Central African governments to fight corruption and uphold the human rights of those who expose graft. The Gambian government agrees to honor a ruling by the ECOWAS Court of Justice about one of Yahya Jammeh's crimes. Sierra Leone's opposition APC party will boycott tomorrow's first meeting of parliament since the June 24 election.
We have stated our position, and as a political party, we expect to be engaged. But up to now, nobody has done that, and the party position remains the same, that members of parliament will not go to parliament until our requests are addressed.
And female leaders of the Fulani tribe say women can play a vital role in reducing long-running friction with farming communities. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The Director General of Malawi's Anti-Corruption Bureau says the fight against graft and malfeasance in Malawi continues with the support of President Lazaro Chakwera's government and despite what she calls corruption fighting back. Martha Chizuma has come under criticism by some and was even arrested last December for allegedly committing an offense when she criticized the director of public prosecution in leaked audio of a phone discussion with a third party. On Africa Anti-Corruption Day yesterday, Tuesday, Chizuma says she has managed to depoliticize the fight against graft by taking on corruption within the government. Chizuma tells me her bureau has made progress in the fight against the crime.
From my perspective, it's kind of a mixed bag, but in that mixed bag, there are a lot of positives. And so I think in the past 2 years, we've seen big inroads being done in the anti-corruption fight. At the same time, of course, there's been a lot of pushback to it. But all in all, I believe that we are on the right path, albeit one thing that has come out is that Malawians now know how ugly this vice is. The Anti-Corruption Bureau keeps on moving forward. There has been quite some good support for government. So when you put all that together, the net effect is that there has been some positive move in the fight against corruption.
Malawi has been known for some of the high-profile corruption cases in Africa, including the 2022 allegations against the former Vice President Saulos Chilima. What is the status now in that case?
So the status at the moment is that the case has now been committed to the Financial Crimes Court from the Magistrate Court. At the moment, the court has given us up to the 22nd of July to file what we call disclosures on file, after which now the Vice President is going to take plea and the court will provide directions on how the matter will proceed.
Do you find, madam, that the fight against corruption has or is becoming too political? For example, some in Malawi have accused your anti-corruption bureau of being selective in bringing corruption cases. What's your response?
So, for starters, it is not correct that the bureau has been used for some political gains. And I think it's very unfortunate when such sentiments come. But at the same time, I acknowledge that issues of anti-corruption are usually politicized, and that's what people are used to. But all in all, we have withstood that pressure. The bureau has not been used to deal with other political opponents at any time, because we have managed to stick to principle and to do what is right and only within the mandate. And one thing that I think we have seen happening in the recent months is how we have managed as a bureau to depoliticize the anti-corruption fight, in the sense that for the very first time, or maybe after a long time, we've seen that even the current government is being taken to account. It's something that people may just dismiss as a small thing, but when I hear stories from across Africa from my colleagues, usually you don't see an anti-corruption bureau or an anti-corruption agency like ours dealing with grand corruption of a current government. This is what we've done. So I would like to dispute the assertion that we've been used for political gains. That is not correct.
You make a very good point, because, and when you talk about other countries where the governments there try to interfere with the work of the Anti-Corruption Commission, because I think recently some people tried to accuse you of something, but I think the president defended you. Is that correct?
Well, maybe if you could be a bit more specific on that, but the fact is that the past 2 years, I have seen a lot of what you'd call corruption fighting back. And me being the head of the anti-corruption, I faced the brunt of that. So, yes, I've had cases against me. I was arrested. I was interdicted. I'm back to work. So a lot of things have happened to me.
Martha Chizuma is the Director General of Malawi's Anti-Corruption Bureau. She was speaking with us from the capital, Lilongwe. Amnesty International has called on authorities in Western Central Africa to fight corruption and uphold the human rights of those who expose it. Amnesty elaborates on the problems they face in a new report entitled Anti-Corruption Fight in Peril, Crackdown on Anti-Corruption Human Rights Defenders in West and Central Africa. The study says anti-corruption activists in 19 West and Central African countries risk arrest, harassment, detention, hefty fines, and even death for speaking out against graft and malfeasance. Lilian Mouan is Amnesty International's senior advisor on corruption and human rights for West and Central Africa. She tells me the region's governments must live up to their international human rights obligations to protect the rights of those who take a stand against the scourge.
African states, more generally, have committed to combating corruption, in particular by ratifying regional and international treaties, such as the African Union Convention on Preventing and Combating Corruption, which celebrates 20 years anniversary on the 11th of July, so today. The African Union has also declared the year 2018 as the African Anti-Corruption Year. What we have witnessed, though, since 2018 is a contradiction. So on the one hand, you have 48 of the 55 AU member states that have ratified the convention and adopted national mechanisms to fight corruption. At the same time, you see that corruption is thriving, you know, in Africa in a climate of severe restriction on human rights and civic space that limits the ability of human rights defenders fighting corruption to hold powerful actors to account for corruption and human rights abuses. So the report is really to draw attention to this contradiction, draw attention of African citizens, African states, and African institutions.
Can you give us at least one or two examples about the kind of repression that anti-corruption activists are subject to in which countries?
So again, just a bit of background. The report covers 19 countries in West and Central Africa. Those are the countries that the regional office for West and Central Africa covers. The report includes 31 cases of repression of anti-corruption and human rights defenders. This repression takes many forms. So they range from attacks on the right to freedom of expression and peaceful assembly, for example, using defamation or fake news provisions, to bans on protests, to even personal attacks such as threats, dismissals, economic harassment, torture, and unlawful killings of anti-corruption human rights defenders. We have, for example, in Niger, the case of the investigative journalist and blogger Samuel Sabou, who was convicted of defamation by electronic communication, based on Niger's cybercrime law, and sentenced to 1 month in prison and a $100 fine. She was simply convicted for republishing a May 21 article from the Geneva-based Global Initiative Against Transnational Organized Crime, which alleged that a drug shipment seized by the Niger anti-trafficking agency was reacquired by drug traffickers and leaked back into the market. So that's one example of one case that we mentioned in the report.
Lillian, before I let you go, what do you think can be done? How do we prevent such behavior?
We think that this behavior thrives in a culture of impunity. So we call on the state to really end impunity. Impunity not only for corruption practices, but also impunity for attacks against those human rights defenders who denounce the corrupt practices.
Lillian Mwan is Amnesty International Senior Advisor on Corruption and Human Rights for Western Central Africa. She was speaking with me from Senegal's capital, Dakar. Sierra Leone's parliament is expected to convene this Thursday for the first time since the results of the June 24 elections were announced. President Julius Maada Bio of the ruling Sierra Leone People's Party, the SLPP, won re-election and has been sworn in. The Electoral Commission says the SLPP won the majority in parliament, 81 seats, against the opposition All People's Congress APC party with 54 seats. However, the APC has rejected the results and said it will not participate at any level of governance because it says the government tampered with the results to hand itself the majority. Abdul Kabo is an APC member of parliament. He tells me that APC members will boycott parliament on Thursday.
Of course, the party has so many concerns relating to the conduct of the elections. We all know how the elections was conducted. Seats belonging to the opposition, we are taking away from them. We know that the collation process at the Vitaly Center was not transparent. And then, for example, here we have a culture of voting. We are whosoever votes for president may likely vote for the political party of the president. But you could not imagine in local district where I come from, we have 27,000 votes for the president and for the member of parliament, just because they wanted to take most of our seats, they gave themselves over 60,000 votes for member of parliament. And when the results were tallied at the tally center, counting officers, counting agents, that is those of us representing political parties at the tally center, we are not allowed to even know what was included in the system. We didn't see what was collated. You know, they just entered figure. And the Public Elections Act is very clear that district results must be certified. You know, and the certification process, political parties are shown the results and are asked to confirm it, whether it's the same with what is on their RR form, you know, so that they append their signature to certify that what is on their RR form is what was collated. But that didn't happen.
But Honorable Kabo, President Julius Maada Bio has already been sworn in for his second term. I hear what you're saying, but what is the remedy? What does the APC intend to do?
Like we said, we have stated our position. And as a political party, we expect to be engaged. We expect to be approached. But up to now, nobody has done that. Nobody has even called the party. Nobody has spoken to the party. And then the party position remains the same, that members of parliament will not go to parliament until our requests are addressed.
There are those who say, Honorable, that if you do not go to parliament, you will be silencing the voice or the voices of the people who elected you. They say, why not you go to parliament and continue to fight there?
In fact, the decision not to go to parliament did not emanate from members of parliament, because members of parliament would be paid salaries. Members of parliament would be given allowances. But that is not the question. People who voted members of parliament did not feel good that their vote did not reflect in the elections. So conscientiously, from our various constituencies, they have asked us to refrain. And it was because of the pressure on the party from the ordinary people who casted their votes. That was why the party resolved, called the meeting, and resolved that members of parliament should not go to parliament. And even when members of parliament were invited to meeting, when the proposal was brought forward to us, members of parliament, consensus, we all signed the document, except for one member of parliament who was not at the meeting at the time the signing was done.
Does the APC intend to go to court, or, as you said, you like to engage, or you like for the SLPP to engage you?
In fact, the party has done a press release, which is indicative of the fact that we will not go to court, because this is not the fourth time the party has approached the court. The party has approached the court on several occasions, including the 2018 elections. And up to now, the court has not taken any position on all of the matters that the party has put forward to it. So APC has decided as a political party that we have lost faith in the court and we are not going to approach the court.
Honorable Abdul Kabo is a member of Sierra Leone Parliament with the opposition APC. He was speaking with me from the capital, Freetown. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, July 12. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. VOA's English to Africa service celebrates its 60th anniversary on August 4th this year. Help us to celebrate by sharing your thoughts on our programs. Send a voice message or text to this WhatsApp number, +1 202 258 3076. Once again, +1 202 258 3076. Tell us what your favorite program is, or let us know about a particular news story. Recall a favorite memory about VOA Africa and tell us what stories you think we should cover or how we can improve. The WhatsApp number once again is +1 202 258 3076. +1 202 258 3076. And we thank you for 60 years of support. The Gambian government says it will honor the ruling of the Court of Justice of the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS. The court ruled on July 5th that Gambia must pay $110,000 to the daughter of a Gambian citizen and a critic of former President Yahya Jammeh, who disappeared while on a visit to the Casamance region. The court agreed with Nana Jo Ndau that her father's right to life was violated. Meanwhile, the Gambian government also says it accepts the U.S. government's expulsion of three Gambian diplomats for alleged visa fraud. I spoke about those developments with Gambian government spokesperson Ibrahima Sankare.
The Gambia government has received the verdict in good faith, and it is regrettable that the father for whom this award is actually given was a very good citizen, a human rights activist, a well-known Gambian who had to die for no reason for speaking his mind against a tyrannical state. Since coming to power, President Barrow's government has inherited several criminal liabilities attributed to the former dictatorship under President Jammeh. So the Gambian government is not appealing the verdict of the court. It has taken it in good faith, and certainly the mechanism, the modalities are underway, and subsequently the daughter of the deceased, Ms. Ndau, will certainly get her compensation as prescribed by the court party. You can also recall that the slain Gambian journalist, Leda Haidara, and the disappeared Gambian journalist, Ibrahim Omane, and several opposition elements during the Jammeh regime also had petitioned the same court, the Community Court of Justice of the West African Community, ECOWAS, and they too had the court rule on their behalf, and the Gambia government has been very compliant. So this is the fourth time, really, that the government of President Barrow is accepting the verdict of this Community Court of Justice.
Unlike other West African governments, let's say, for example, there have been several rulings for Liberia, and the government there has not been able to pay for damages that were awarded by the court. Why did your government now decide to accept it?
Yes, you know, it is a continuation. You know, administration, politics, governance is just a continuum. So President Barrow is the one who replaced President Jammeh, who was a tyrant. Barrow cried foul, and every Gambian rallied behind him, and we opened the dictatorship democratically. So certainly and obviously, it is quite natural that those that suffered under the dictatorship that we all fought against, you know, when they go to court and they win the day, that we should also celebrate them and honor the verdict of the court.
So let me ask you about another incident. How true is it that a number of your diplomats in Washington have been expelled by the U.S.?
It is true, unfortunately. It is regrettable that the deputy head of mission, the deputy ambassador to the United States in Washington, D.C., and actually three others have been asked to park following allegations of misconduct on their part. One person among the four is accused of China being not sexual molestation, but by battering a child with a mob. The three orders are linked with allegations of visa fraud. The Gambian government has accepted again the American government's position in having us withdraw these diplomats from our mission in Washington. And based on the notice, the diplomatic notice from the State Department, they've been asked to leave no later than the 17th of July, which is next week, Monday. And the government of President Barrow has agreed that they will return to Gambia. However, given the scanty nature of the information provided on the allegations, the Gambia government would also conduct its own investigation when and if these people return to Gambia.
Ibrahima Sankare is the Gambian government spokesperson. He was speaking with me from the capital, Banjul. Female leaders of the Fulani, an ethnic group of mostly nomadic herders across West Africa and the Sahel, say women can play a vital role in reducing long-running friction with farming communities. In this report from Lake Chad, reporter Henry Wilkins meets women making digital maps to establish boundaries between the two communities.
By Lake Chad, members of the Fulani community, a group of nomadic herders found across West Africa and the Sahel, have clashed with farmers for as long as anyone here can remember. Cattle roam onto farms and eat crops, while farmers plough land that has traditionally been used by the Fulani for grazing. A non-profit called the Association for Indigenous Women and Peoples of Chad, or AFPAT for short, is trying to change that through a project that draws on the local knowledge of women to make maps. Through discussions led by AFPAT, farmers and herders agree on what land can be used by who. AFPAT's founder, Hindu Ibrahim, told VOA the maps allow herders
to put all the traditional knowledge that they have, because there is no science or technology in that communities. It can help to mitigate the conflict between them, because when they map their resources, they know how they can put a clear strategy of sharing and accessing those resources, but conserving them for the long term.
Ibrahim, who has won a range of international awards for her activism promoting the role of women in society and environmental issues, says that women played an essential role in the discussions that made these maps possible.
So women have a very important and rich traditional knowledge. And most of the time, we do not consider women to come and contribute into the decision-making, because we are all in patriarchal decision-making communities.
Disputes between herders and farmers have been partially blamed for insecurity in West Africa and recruitment by extremist groups linked to Al-Qaeda and Islamic State. Activists like Ibrahim and Animatu Ado Jibo from the Nigeria-based non-profit Fulbe Development and Cultural Organization say empowering women and involving them more in the Fulani community can reduce the risk of communities siding with extremists. Jibo, who uses the term Fulbe, another name for the Fulani people, says literacy is key to achieving this.
Not only the literacy that we are doing, but also the skills acquisition to the Fulbe women, so that they can be able to help their families. And we also enlighten them to stop movement from one place to another, let them enroll their children into the Western education.
Whatever the approach, activists believe Fulani women have an essential role to play in reducing insecurity. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Lake Chad, Chad.
And that's it for this Wednesday, July 12th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for coming aboard with us this morning. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I am James Barty in Washington, wishing that you will have a very nice day.
We are bringing women voices to the conversation on things that matter to the hearts and minds of women. From right here in the nation's capital to on the ground from all over the African continent. We hear your voices. Our voices. Right here on VOA on Wednesdays at 1900 UTC.